Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Patrick Healy. I'm a judge in the criminal division of the Cour du Québec here in Montreal, and it's my pleasure to chair this final session of the conference. I was only able to attend the last half of the last session, but it really was of a very high quality. The question that we have for this final session is very broad, and it allows a wide range of perspectives to be given on the topics that it raises. What are the key challenges facing Canada in the areas of justice and policing in the near future? What is the justice that we need for Canada, and how might we best achieve this? You know, in 1978, Brian Dixon wrote a judgment for the Supreme Court of Canada on a topic that is not really before you. He was talking about the relationship between regulatory offenses or public welfare offenses and general principles of criminal law. And he had a sentence in that judgment which said, public welfare offenses lie in a field of conflicting values. That phrase, a field of conflicting values, it seems to me could describe the whole of the criminal law and criminal justice at any time. But no more so than now. And I think that our panelists will address that. It is also perhaps the reason why there's been a slight change in the program. I've taken off my jersey as a player and put on a jersey as a referee in order to avoid embroiling myself in things that I shouldn't do. Of course, I do have ideas. And if I were to speak about ideas, which I might, the ideas that I would like to speak about would be reform, restraint, and respect. With respect to the last one, I particularly mean respect for people who have to exercise difficult judgments in difficult circumstances, circumstances that cannot be foreseen by legislative enactments, circumstances that have to take into account the very difficult factual situations that people face on a daily basis. But if there's time, I'll address some things relating to reform, restraint, and respect. First, I'd like to call upon Senator Cowan, leader of the opposition in the Senate, to address us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to be part of such a distinguished panel. I want to thank the Institute and my friend Marlene Jennings for her work in organizing this conference. It's both timely and important because from where I sit as a parliamentarian, there appears to be a disconnect between the justice we need, which is the topic of this panel, and what I fear is the future of justice in Canada, which is the larger subject of the conference. In Ottawa, I've watched with growing concern the rollout of this government's so-called tough on crime agenda. From its Tackling Violent Crime Act of 2008 through the most recent omnibus Safe Streets and Communities Act and the many bills in between. Many Canadians have noticed that the government likes to give rather loaded titles to its bills, perhaps in an attempt to make them think twice about coming up against them. How many politicians will stand up against safe streets and communities? The controversial Bill C-30 is named Protecting Children from Internet Predators Act, instead of what others might consider a more appropriate title, like your government wants to snoop on your internet use. You'll all recall the old British comedy series, Yes, Minister. It had a wonderful take on these kinds of titles. Sir Humphrey Appleby, the supreme bureaucrat, said in one episode, I explained that we are calling the white paper open government because you always dispose of the difficult bit in the title. It does less harm there than in the statute books. It's the law of inverse relevance. The less you intend to do about something, the more you keep talking about it. And I guess that's the case here with this tough on crime agenda. The crime bills culminating in Bill C-10 have focused on changing the principles of sentencing in our criminal justice system. The new approach is grounded on punishment through prison time and denunciation. And one of the major tools deployed for this purpose is increasing use of mandatory minimum sentences. Every study I've seen, every expert I've spoken to, every report I've read said that mandatory minimums simply will not work to prevent, to deter, or to reduce crime. Indeed, they're more likely to produce exactly the opposite result, as prison can serve as a school for crime for first-time nonviolent offenders. Mandatory minimums will not give us the justice we need. This isn't or shouldn't be a partisan issue. Prominent Republicans like Newt Gingrich and former Governor Jeb Bush have come out saying that mandatory minimums simply don't work. Eric Sterling was associate counsel or assistant counsel in the U.S. House of Representatives, and as he described it recently, the first draft laws on mandatory minimums for drug offenses came off his word processor. He now spends a great deal of time and energy advocating against those kinds of laws. He shakes his head in disbelief as he watches us go down this road, which has proven to be such a costly failure in the U.S. I believe that the justice we need is one that's grounded in evidence and facts, not ideology and politics. We're fortunate in Canada. The crime rate has been falling pretty steadily for years now. Indeed, the latest estimates say that it's at its lowest rate in 30 years. The current government downplays these statistics because it doesn't conform to the picture that it wants to portray for Canadians. Public Safety Minister Vic Taves actually told our Senate Committee on Legal and Constitutional Affairs when he appeared on Bill C-10 that he doesn't care that the statistics say that crime is down. He is, as he said, focused on danger. And that's what C-10 is focused on as well. In my opinion, we should be focused on facts and statistics. They tell us that our criminal justice system has been working reasonably well. Can it be improved? Absolutely. But improving a system is very different from radically changing it with measures that are not supported by the evidence. Here are some more statistics. While Aboriginal Canadians are only 3% of the general population, they make up about 20% of the federal prison population. Out west, the statistics are even worse. In Saskatchewan, Aboriginal Canadians comprise 11% of the population, but 81% of the new admissions to prison. As Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo has said many times, children in some Aboriginal communities are more likely to end up in jail than to graduate from high school. Some more statistics. 38% of men admitted to federal penitentiaries appear to have mental health problems. Among women, the statistic is even worse. More than 50% of women admitted to federal penitentiaries require further mental health assessment. More and more women are being sent to prison, and over the past 10 years, the number of Aboriginal women in custody has increased by 86.4%. And who are the women in our prisons? In 2010, 86% of women offenders reported histories of physical abuse and 68% sexual abuse. And here's one more uncomfortable statistic. According to the Canadian Centre for Substance Abuse, at least 7 out of 10 offenders in the federal correctional system have engaged in what they call problematic use of alcohol and other drugs during the one-year period prior to incarceration. These are the kinds of facts that should be the starting point for any serious effort to obtain the justice we need in Canada. But the path we are taking will see us spending billions to incarcerate people who are suffering from mental illness and alcohol and drug addictions. Our prisons are not equipped to deal with these problems. And frankly, I don't think they should be. I don't go to hospital expecting them to provide correctional services. And Canadians should not be sent to prison to receive mental health services. And locking up someone who suffers from mental illness without providing the mental health services they need means that when they get out, and eventually they will return to the community, their problems will be worse, and the risk to the community possibly greater than when they went in. How does that make our streets and communities safer? How will this bring us the justice we need? The justice we need would distinguish true criminals from those with mental health illnesses and provide the care they need instead of simply locking them up. Justice Barry Stewart, retired chief judge of the Yukon Territorial Court, testified before us in the Senate committee studying C-10. He has a long experience with Aboriginal offenders. He told us that since leaving the bench, he's been visiting some of what he called his customers. And in one of those sessions in a jail, he held a circle. And he asked the offenders in the circle to put up their hands if they'd ever been in care. Of the 27 offenders, and this was in a maximum security prison, over three-quarters had been in care. And of course, this cycle will continue, because with the new mandatory minimum sentences, even more children will be raised in care because their parents are in prison. Professor Michael Jackson, who spoke so eloquently here a few moments ago, also spoke and testified before the Senate committee. He told us that prison has become for young Aboriginal men and women what the residential school was for their parents and grandparents. Justice Stewart believes adamantly that we spend far too much money at the end of the process on criminal justice and our criminal system, our prison system, and nowhere near enough at the front end where the problems set in. I agree with him. The justice we need doesn't happen only in a courtroom or a police station or a prison, and it certainly won't come from a federal government passing more crime bills like C-10. The justice we need requires that the federal government work closely with provincial and territorial governments, with local community organizations, to make sure that we have the supports in place at all levels to address the real issues facing Canadian today. Prime Minister Trudeau spoke of a just society. I think he had it right. Address the many terribly serious problems facing so many Aboriginal Canadians today, and you'd cut out so much of the crime before it ever starts. The same problems of mental illness, poverty, alcohol and drug addictions. Ignore these problems, put the scarce resources to building prisons, and you're simply compounding the problem at a terrible cost in lives as well as money. The current government likes to position itself as defenders of the victims of crime. They like to suggest that you're either on the side of the victims or you're on the side of the criminals. Well, as some statistics I set out a moment ago show, these are not such watertight compartments. The justice we need would address domestic violence and abuse. It would focus on providing serious help to victims, not by focusing on vengeance, how long a sentence a perpetrator will get, but serious concrete help to stop the cycle of crime that we know will set in. I realize my time's almost up, but I want to mention one other serious problem with mandatory minimum sentences. As I said before, we have an excellent criminal justice system in Canada, one that is the envy of the world. It's a model for systems around the world. A fundamental principle of this system is its careful balance of the roles, powers, and responsibilities amongst the police, the Crown prosecutor, the defense lawyer, and the judge. In our system, and this goes back centuries in the British legal tradition, a judge decides each case on its merits, judging the accused person before him or her on that day. It's not a one-size-fits-all justice system. As I said in the Senate about Bill C-10, criminal justice is not a vending machine where you press a button, A1 or B5 or B6, and out pops a sentence. Vending machines usually dispense junk food, and we should aim for something higher than when it comes to dispensing justice for Canadians. No two cases are identical. No two crimes are the same. Motives differ. As a legislator, I'm troubled because I'm being asked to set a mandatory minimum. I'm being asked to judge cases years in advance, perhaps decades in advance. The offender may not even be born when this law passes. And yet, I am condemning him or her to prison. This shouldn't be my decision. That's the role of our judges. They're trained to exercise discretion. Yes, judgment. Indeed, they were appointed judges because of their ability to exercise that discretion with wisdom and good judgment. Our criminal justice system is already straining under the demands placed upon it, as we heard earlier. And that's before C-10 comes into force. Right now, about 15% of cases go to trial. If we double that, the whole system simply shuts down. And everyone, even the Justice Minister, recognizes that some crimes that carry a mandatory minimum sentence under C-10 should in fact not receive it, such as a teenager offered to share some ecstasy with a friend at a party. No money involved, and even if the friend declines, that's trafficking. But that's not the justice we need. So everyone is assuming that someone will exercise discretion so that everyone in a situation like that won't be charged, and all cases will go to trial. But with discretion removed from the judge, it will fall to the Crown and indeed to the police. And as confident as I am in the professionalism and integrity of our police forces, I'm not prepared to give every police officer that much discretion. So I'll conclude with this. The justice we need respects the fundamental critical balance in our criminal justice system, allowing judges to judge, police to police, and prosecutors to prosecute. And the whole thing depends on letting our health care system address illness, including mental illness and addiction, and not passing those health problems to our judicial and prison system. This conference is about criminal justice. But I suggest to you it's bigger than that. It's about social justice. And it says a lot about the kind of society we are and the kind of society we want to be. And I urge you to continue to address, as you have in the course of these couple of days, to look on and see the Smart Justice Network that some of my colleagues referred to earlier. Civil society is really rising up about these issues, and we need to continue this discussion. This is too serious a matter to be left solely to the politicians. And I say that with the greatest respect. It's too serious a matter to be left to the lawyers and to the judges. It's a matter for society as a whole to address, and you are an important part of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Cowan. Sandra de la Ronde is the executive director of the Helen Betty Osborne Memorial Foundation, and it's my pleasure to invite her to speak.
Good afternoon. This is going to sound odd, but I feel like the 1%. Not having listening to the dismal statistics about Indigenous people and the rates of incarceration, I just go, "Whew, I'm here." So thank you for the invitation to come and speak with you this afternoon. And before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge our ancestors, my ancestors and your ancestors that walked this land together and still continue to walk this land with us. We may not see them, but they're here, and they're bringing with them a sense of respect and wholeness that we can sit together as individuals, as nations of people, to come for a solution. Come together again for a solution and listen to each other with our hearts and our minds together. So I just want to say thank you to those ancestors and the spirits among us. I also want to thank the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada for the invitation, and especially my dear friend, Judy Rebick, who is always creating space for people for their own voices to be heard. So thank you, Judy. So what is the justice we need for Canada? And more particularly, I want to address what is the justice we need for Aboriginal people and how best might we work together to achieve this. We know, as it's been stated in the Prairies, and I'll just mention it again, that over 50% of the inmates in the two federal institutions are Aboriginal persons, and 70% of the individuals in provincial institutions are Aboriginal. 50% of the admissions in Manitoba are Indigenous women. And Indigenous offenders make up more than two-thirds of those in custody and less than half of those serving conditional sentences. We know and feel as Indigenous people in this country that there is a different set of laws or the application of law in the criminal code to Aboriginal people as there is to the rest of Canada. Also, we know that the majority of Aboriginal offenders are held until the end of their warrant expiry date when they go to appear before parole hearings. If they get that far, they are often denied early release. In Manitoba, I'd also like to note that 80% of the more than 10,000 children in care are Indigenous children. Another alarming statistic that you may or may not be aware of is that over 600 of the missing and murdered women and girls in this country are Indigenous women and girls. This is all the while Indigenous people only make up 4% of the Canadian population. And so, you know, this was said earlier that maybe it's 3%, 3 or 4%. It's still not a huge number as compared to the other statistics that have been shared with you this afternoon. What you should also know is that Aboriginal people or Indigenous people are the fastest growing population in the country. So expect that percentage to change. Although let us not expect that that percentage will increase in terms of incarceration or rates of criminality in the country. Certainly the biggest challenge that Canada, one of the biggest challenges Canada is facing is the impact of Bill C-10 on our communities. And we want to know, and we ask the question, is it about the crime, is it about the criminal code, or is there a bigger picture that the Canadian legislatures are trying to address? And we wonder why this particular bill will have such an impact on the Aboriginal community, and why the statistics continue to be so grim for Indigenous people. It was noted earlier, Pierre Trudeau had talked about the situation of Indigenous people and how putting your money in prevention will make a change. And here we are, almost 50 or 60 years later, a royal commission sits on the shelf, and various other reports that deal with the issues of Indigenous people. Nothing has changed. In fact, the situations do get incrementally worse. And we can say from the Royal Commission, let me talk about the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry in Manitoba in 93. They talked about to do nothing would create greater problems, and at the time of the review of the commission, there was not. There may have been street gangs, but those numbers were minimal and certainly were not part of the fabric of the Indigenous community. In fact, not a part of the fabric of this country. Failure to do anything with regards to the recommendations has resulted in just a perversion of street gangs and street gang mentality in our communities. Why is this? Just for a moment, let me refer you to a new book, only available as on your e-reader, and it's a commercial for Judy. It's called Occupy This. Judy Rebick, get it. It's only $3.99. It's a good read. But for me, you know, she interviewed a young man named Jamie Bigger about the Occupy movement. And he was talking about a national news company that was going to report on an activity of Occupy. But they chose not to because, I can't remember, something else had come out. But the young man says, I felt a white-hot anger. I experienced generational betrayal, a rupturing of the social contract. I felt like I had been drop-kicked out of the window of Canadian society. That's just one event, one day, in the life of a non-Aboriginal Canadian. I have to tell you, that's what it is for Aboriginal people every day. So it's hard not to be angry. And we look at the increasing statistics as on one hand, Canada has said, we will listen to you as a people. So we've had the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry. We've had the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People. We've had the Charlottetown Accord. We've had Meech Lake. We've had the Kelowna Accord. None in all those discussions and sitting at the table, the leadership of the Aboriginal people believed the time for change had come. That the people sitting on the other side of the table were sitting there in a respectful way, and like the time of the development of the treaties, that there was going to be an honoring of that relationship. And we know that there has never been an honoring of those relationships from the treaty forward. How does that impact, or what does that mean to an Aboriginal person on the street, a homeless Aboriginal person on the street? A few years ago, Phil Fontaine, when he was national chief, had spoken to the Canadian Club in Ottawa. And when he spoke, he cried because that work, all the work that they had been done, had never been acknowledged. The Kelowna Accord was, again, another broken treaty, another broken agreement. A week later, I went to a walk-in clinic at in my area of Winnipeg, and there was a homeless man that was standing in the middle of the lobby, and he stood in the middle of the lobby in a waiting room full of people and cried the same tears as Phil Fontaine for the same reason. He said, I thought we were equal, but we're not. So we are, I think from that example you can see that we are all one people. One of the elders had said, the honor of all. The honor of one is the honor of all. The hurt of one is the hurt of all. And that's so true. Not only do we see this hurt, but we also see the legacy of children in care. As was noted earlier, the Indigenous people that have been asked if they have been in care right from the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry forward have all said they've spent time in the foster care system. we have individuals who have suffered from the effects of the intergenerational trauma of residential schools. Plus the, so, and in addition, the lack of ability of governments to follow through on their agreements. So, is there any doubt why people are angry? Why Indigenous people are angry? And so some people just are not able to channel that anger. Or once they get to the court systems, are unfairly dealt with. I know that I did my research on the utilization of the Gladue factors in Manitoba provincial courts. One of the, or the judiciary had said, well, we don't want to apply it because we, because the defense counsel aren't identifying who's Aboriginal, and we don't want to ask because we don't want to appear to be racist. So, you know, if somebody commits a crime, the crime is the same whether they're, you know, the punishment is the same whether they're Aboriginal or not. So, as a result, we've seen that since the clarification of the Gladue decision by the Supreme Court, there's actually been an increase of sentencing of Aboriginal people in this thought not to be seen to be racist. So, so then it comes down to what is happening today, Bill C-10 and its impact on Indigenous people. Recently in January, there was the national summit held between the Prime Minister and the Indigenous leadership. If there was anything that really told the story about the relationship between Indigenous Canada and the government, it was in the gift that was presented by the Governor General to the National Chief, a painting of the Battle of the Plains of Abraham. So I think that really unconsciously, or maybe consciously, that there is still a pitched battle to eliminate Indigenous people through continuing affirmation of genocidal policies. And I said because the making of the treaties was the first step. Our people went forward to the table, and I'm certain the negotiators on the other side went back, went to the table too with good intentions. I always think, and it was a treaty relationship. Can you, who do you think had the understanding of the land? Who do you think put in the treaties for as long as the grass grows, the rivers flow, and the sun shines? Would it be a government negotiator or someone who lived off the land? So our people, I think, were very strong in their understanding of what it takes to be in relationship with the land and with each other. And that has never been a position that we can see has been taken by successive governments in this country. So it's like being a seamstress or a woodworker, and you make a mistake in your first couple lines in the base work that you're doing, and you go, oh. Rather than tear it up, you just keep working around it, and then you finish your garment or your piece of woodwork. But at the end of it, when you look at it, you can still see that mistake or that seam being crooked, right? So the only way to manage that is to take the whole thing apart and start again from the place where it worked, where your seams fit together perfectly, and then you start sewing again. And I think that's what we have to do with the relationship between Canada and Indigenous people. Take it apart to that seam where it worked, and that would be the making of the treaties. I could talk to you about the number of policies that were put in place, like this making of your seams, but you know that story. Or maybe you don't. But I'm assuming you're here at this conference because you do know, so I'm not going to repeat it. So I want to say that sometimes when we talk about change, it's something that we can't expect anyone, institutions, or government to take on for us. The change must come from the individual, or an individual body, an individual nation. And in terms of Bill C-10, I just think it was mentioned that CSC has a budget coming up of $3 billion. Imagine if I were to dream, and if you were to dream with me, if the government put the same amount of money into prevention, community and youth programs, or restorative justice, what would Canada look like? I can say where they have put money into restorative justice, that such as the MKO, which is Manitoba Kiwetinohi Ogamaganuk, it's the Cree body in northern Manitoba, their First Nations justice strategy, that over 50% of the individuals that were referred to community justice over a period of 10 years did not reoffend. And I would also say that if the judiciary must incarcerate individuals, then they need to take into account the provisions of Section 17.2E, and that is commonly referred to as the Gladue decision. But also some of those issues around 18.2E is providing support to the defense or to the individuals or communities to write the Gladue reports, and to have a standard of what those reports should be, as well as not be seen just as a document for the courts, but as a document for the individual to be responsible for their own healing and restorative processes in their families and communities. And I think that and I have to say I did speak to a number of people and organizations in this in my communities of interest before I came out here, because I didn't want it to be just my words. You know, I really wanted you to understand that this is coming from a place of community, a place of the Indigenous community, so that I'm not standing up here alone. So in terms of practical measures, we know through time that the government will continue to implement legislation and policies that limit the ability of Indigenous people to move in this community. And we wondered lately, about the increasing incarceration rates, the understanding of the importance of the land and its resources. And are those two things connected? Is Bill C-30 or Bill C-10 a way of continuing to lock up those that resist the oppression and I don't want to say it, but the rape of the land, especially the tar sands projects? Is it a way to put more people in jail so that there's less resistance to maintaining the land and maintaining the health of Mother Earth? I think Jim Cowan had mentioned earlier that about how he felt in the vote and making a law for a generation that's not even born yet, and the impact of that law on the generation that's not born yet. This law is that it is the impact on the generations to come, and I believe, and those people in my community believe, it's also impact. It's a law that's going to impact not only the generations today, but the generations to come, and the generation's ability to fight or to stand for the land and for the people and for freedom. So if there's a way that this community, the McGill community, the legal community, and in fact Canada, can change the course of history and the impact of this law on Indigenous people, in fact this country, use the systems that you are most familiar with, what would be, could the defense bar or the Canadian Judicial Council challenge this law through by taking it to the Supreme Court as a challenge to their authority and independence? That's something that should be tried. And more importantly, what are the things that we can do as well? You know, as institutions, you can change your curriculum to include more, or to include an understanding or an analysis of Indigenous people in their relationship to the rest of Canada. More than anything, that will make a difference in the criminal court system, because lawyers will understand when they're defending people what the nature of that relationship is. And I think that you'll find that the defense of individuals will then be different. What can each of us do? Let's again focus on prevention. Each of us can use our own courage, our own brains, and go and volunteer as a tutor, participate in prevention programs. And you can't do it by whole groups of people. You create change by doing your work one person at a time. We create change by doing our work one person at a time. And I am the executive director of the Helen Betty Osborne Foundation, which is a foundation, one of the few foundations in Canada that's legislated into being, and our purpose is to raise funds for post-secondary Aboriginal students and to advance the legacy of and life of Helen Betty Osborne, which is, you know, really wide open. But if we want to be part of the change, you can donate to the foundation or any other foundation that advances education for people. And that's how we're going to make a different Canada. So really, a just Canada and a just society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. de la Londe. It is now my pleasure to invite Professor Carrie Rentschler to speak. She is a member of the Department of Art History and Communication Studies. She's also the director of the McGill Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor to be here to even attempt to answer the question of what is the justice we need. A number of our speakers at this conference have already begun to address this question in some fundamental ways, including my fellow panelists. And what I want to do is echo some of what has already been said, but also point to some what I think are concrete actions and ways of thinking that are a necessary feature to a socially just society, which to me means a society in which no form of oppression is tolerated. We do not currently live in such a society. My brief comments today are drawn from my own research on some of the social movements that respond to crime and violence, particularly in the United States, from a victim and survivor perspective. And my perspective is as an American who has been steeped in the U.S. rhetoric of the war on crime, the war on drugs, and the war on terror, and has been something I've been trying to work against in my own anti-violence education. So I see the Canadian system and the justice issues we face here from this set of experiences, the non-native experience. Now, I had originally planned to take most of my time to talk about the Canadian Omnibus Safe Streets and Communities Act. I still have to say a little bit about this, but then I'll say some other things. For now, I will say that it is no coincidence that this bill is basically named after the 1968 U.S. Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act, which set the federal law enforcement agenda of the U.S. war on crime that has devastated communities of color in the states, warehoused over 2 million people in prison, and as many activists and scholars have shown, functions as a present-day form of slavery. Its supporters use the rhetoric of protecting the public. That rhetoric draws on the dominant theme currently of penal and criminal justice policy. The Omnibus Crime Bill is direct evidence of how Canada's political system appropriates the very worst notions of American justice, but I should add that they are certainly not the only notions of justice on which American activists and their social movements draw. From prison abolition to racial, economic, and sexual justice for criminalized communities, and many others that project a vision of actual social justice. Contrary to Canadian Federal Justice Minister Rob Nicholson's declaration that the crime bill is a Canadian solution to Canadian issues, to which he added, and we make no apology for that, it certainly looks, sounds, and feels very familiar to me from the United States. I unfortunately missed his morning address today where he talked a lot about victim interest, but I'll get to that. Awesome. Exacerbating the problem of intervening in the debates about the Canadian Omnibus Crime Bill is an administration that has closed its ears to criticism, as we've already heard. Thank you so much, Senator Cowan, for your work on this. Federal Justice Minister Nicholson admitted to willingly ignoring the warning our American colleagues have shared about mandatory minimums. He admitted to the Canadian press that he did not even read the letter of warning written this February by an author of the U.S. legislation for the imposition of mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses, who we've already heard about, Eric Silver, who warned us that Bill C-10's entrenchment of mandatory minimums would create a Canadian correctional calamity like the one the U.S. currently faces, and as we've heard already, Canada already faces as well. We're headed for this. We're in it. Canada is declaring a war on crime without using the language yet of war, but I expect to be hearing it soon. And as criminologist Jonathan Simon has warned, metaphoric wars on social threats profoundly reshape government, the evidence of which we are clearly seeing now. So what is the justice we need in this context? The justice we need, I think, requires only using the criminal justice system as a last resort for addressing the social problems that arise from deep social inequities and the state and corporate power that reproduce them. To think in this manner requires a major shift in attitude and understanding about violence, its sources, and its prevention, and we've actually already been talking about them here. So we do know these. In a 1998 interview with the PBS program Frontline, Louise Arbour, former chief prosecutor of the International War Crime Tribunal at The Hague, was asked why the UN set up war crime tribunals to address the crimes against humanity committed in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. I found her answer very revealing. She said that, and I quote her, "By the time we have to trigger the criminal process, we've admitted to a monumental failure of all other social institutions. It's an after-the-fact recognition," she said, "that massive crimes have been committed. Criminal justice," she argued, "has to be a long-term investment in peace, actual peace based in a human rights framework of law, not the vision of peace and order that comes from the law and order crime control movement. We need to ask of the criminal justice system, the correctional system, and our administrative systems of welfare and social services, are they working towards peace in Canadian society? For the most part, they don't seem to be. To support peace, to create and support peaceful, nonviolent, and healthy communities, we need to ask the question, as Joanne St. Louis did, of what is a crime? What ought to be a crime? And what should not be a crime? The Canadian Law Commission asked and researched this very set of questions before the Harper administration shuttered its doors in October 2006. In spring of that year, I joined the advisory council of the Canadian Law Commission. Clearly, I didn't serve on it for very long. But it was a government-funded and independent body whose task was to ensure that Canadian law embodied the ideals of justice. As an American, I have to say I was amazed. It's like, wow. There's one of these. They exist. I was even a bit hopeful about the possibilities that we could make evidence-based cases to decriminalize certain behaviors criminalized by the law and decriminalize the communities and populations who are over-policed, whether we're talking prostitution, whether we're talking dissent, or the larger and much more difficult question of whether we can decriminalize violence. Take it out of the criminal justice system and address it differently, because we've been hearing that the prison system does not actually affect violence. The mission of the Law Commission was to renew the law and ensure its relevance, responsiveness, effectiveness, equality of access, and its justness. Its stated task was to orient the law to collective and individual well-being. It used the language of well-being. Not the control of crime, and not public safety, but well-being. We've already heard from others that people are not made safer when more people are warehoused in prisons, where people who have committed violence learn to commit more violence on the inside walls of prisons to survive. In the movement to end sexual violence, one I'm very familiar with, advocates repeatedly testify to the fact that prisons do not stop sexually violent behavior, they increase it. We heard from ex-con Gord and Alan Zweig's film yesterday speak exactly to this issue. And I agree with Alan and the advocates I know that this reality is an injustice. Perhaps we need another independent law commission to start raising some of these issues again. We need to address the needs of victimized and criminalized communities. I say communities because the criminal law deals in individuals. But violence, the issue I'm most concerned about, is a social problem. It's a community problem whose sources are social and institutional. It gets enacted by and through individuals, but addressing only the individuals who become victims and who do violence cannot get at the larger problem. Victims and perpetrators of violence are often the same people. They often come from the same communities, and they often have faced many of the same life hardships and social inequalities. To address the foundations of violence, we need to address victimization and criminalization differently than the criminal law has been doing. In 2004, I came to McGill after finishing my doctoral work in the States, where I researched the American Victims' Rights Movement, its links to law and order advocacy, and the intensification of the war on crime and the war on drugs, a combined war that has led to the disproportionate over-incarceration and warehousing of men and women of color, the indigent, and the addicted. The victims' rights movement has participated in this war. It has helped the government warehouse people of color, most of which has occurred through drug laws and possession offenses and not through violent offenses that the movement itself is most concerned about. So its participation in this isn't actually all that effective in terms of addressing what most matters. Victims' rights legal reforms in the U.S. represents a federalization of a vengeance politics, a desire to punish that's mobilized by the state and done so in the name of victims, whether those victims want it or not. And that is a key thing to keep in mind. One of the things I learned in studying this movement is that a lot of what we hear about victims' rights and from victims' rights advocates is only part of the message, and they are usually being spoken for. There is a diversity of political positions represented in victim movements, both in the U.S. and Canada, and I thank Steve Sullivan on the last panel for speaking to this very well. Most victims are excluded from the very processes of criminal justice enacted in their name. In the U.S., victims and victims' families who are anti-death penalty, who are opposed to three strikes legislation and mandatory minimums, and who are anti-war, find themselves doubly shut out of the channels for publicly communicating how their needs are not served by systems of criminal punishment and the carceral state. Mark Klass, the father who initially supported three strikes legislation in California after the kidnapping and murder of his daughter Polly, had a change of heart about the policy and withdrew his support before the measure was voted on, only to then find himself shut out of the media and the circles of political debate. He was used as a victim's rights advocate. His right to speak was no longer guaranteed once he spoke out against the vengeance measures of three strikes. Now, the victims we tend to see often, the ones who are the face of the movement, are those who tend to be light-skinned. They tend to be young, they tend to be middle class, and they also tend to be female. We tend not to see racialized victims as the face of the victim movement or even in crime news. Who is even granted victim status is an unequal process. In Canada, while some victim advocates supported the abandonment of the long gun registry, mothers of the victims of gun violence powerfully advocated for its continuance. These women include Suzanne LaPlante Edward, mother of Anne-Marie, who was killed at the École Polytechnique on December 6, 1989, and Louise Heavy, mother of Anastasia, who was killed at Dawson College in September 2006. These advocates may not be the dominant face and punitive voice of the victim movement, but they are the key ones for mobilizing a more socially just response to violence grounded in the experiences of those individuals, families, and communities who've been victimized by it. If we want to answer the question of what kinds of justice we need, let's listen closely to people like Mark Klass or Bud Welch, an anti-death penalty advocate whose daughter Julie was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing and who helped found the group Murder Victims Families for Human Rights, or the anti-war victim group September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrow that has developed solidarity networks as victims of 9/11 with families of Afghan victims of U.S. bombing done in retaliation for 9/11. These organizations and their advocates draw on that language of victims' rights, but they do so in order to claim the right to represent another kind of victim politics, a non-retributive one. To address violence, then, these folks suggest, too, that we need to look beyond the criminal justice system to communities and community supports. Criminal law ought not to be the primary tool we use for responding to complex social problems that produce violence. It needs to be the very last one, and we should actually strive to never have to use it. Never. That would be amazing. We ought to ask the question of every social infraction or unwanted behavior, do we need a law for this? Is there a better, more productive, less punitive, more beneficial, and less oppressive way to address this problem? What alternative response mechanisms might better address this issue? Restorative justice, for instance, which Sandra has talked about. Community-based violence intervention initiatives like the violence interrupters on the south side of Chicago, and robust social services and welfare systems that explicitly adopt anti-oppressive practices in which their representatives are adequately trained in how to use them. This means social movements must also shift their focus to look for solutions to violence beyond the law. One of the many problems with changing the system is that we are training our law students to address the law based on what it says and not on what it does or does not do. There are huge discrepancies in what the law says it does and what it actually does. Transgender legal scholar and founder of the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, Dean Spade, addresses this issue directly in his new book, Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Trans Politics, and the Limits of the Law. And I encourage you all to pick up a copy of this book and read it. But the larger question here is how focusing on the law can often prevent us from finding better solutions to violence than things like imprisonment. So we need to listen to what organizations like the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies with Kim Pate tell us about the devastating and violent impact of the criminalization of women, and also the John Howard Society and places like the Sylvia Rivera Law Project in the States, which is making the links between over-incarceration, the criminalization of gender nonconforming people, the criminalization of drug addiction and sex work, and anti-immigration policy. Justice is defined by these groups through a framework that attends to the needs of communities that are victimized and criminalized. They call for holding systems of government accountable for the violence these systems and their representatives enact at the system level. To answer the question of what kind of justice do we need, then, I'm suggesting let's start by listening to these folks. Let's listen to victimized and criminalized communities and their calls for racial, sexual, and economic justice in Canada. Let's not just listen to them. Let's put decision-making power in their hands as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Rentschler. It is now my pleasure to invite my friend and one of Canada's most senior criminal lawyers, Harvey Yourofsky.
I promise that I won't be longer than 7 minutes. Patrick Healy just described me as one of Canada's senior criminal lawyers. I want to tell you something. I started studying law in 1958 and practicing in the criminal justice system in 1962. It is pretty discouraging to note today that the same arguments and the same debate that took place then is still going on now, and that all we get for it is the kind of superficial law that C-10 represents. Professor Jackson talked about President Obama's reference to the arc of history leaning toward justice. And he says that he's still optimistic. Well, I hope we can all share, have reason to share that optimism. The real question that I think has to be addressed, and unfortunately this conference is ending one day short of where it should, is the following. We all know what justice we need. The question is, why don't we have it? Why do we have a system where all of these things that have been described eloquently this afternoon still exist and have existed for a long time? We all know that there are far too many members of minorities, visible minorities, in our jails. We all know that the police do profiling, racial profiling, and stereotyping. We all know about gender discrimination in our system. Why do we still have to see regularly incidents, and this is beyond profiling, this is just incompetence, incidents such as the Vancouver airport incident where that poor Polish man trying to get into Canada was tasered to death by the police? Why do we have to see in Montreal incidents where people who call the police to help somebody who's mentally disturbed end up with that person being shot by the police? We all know what we need. The question is, why don't we have it? I'm afraid I don't have the answers. And the ultimate question is, why do we have a government that can think and believe that C-10 is popular? Because this government would not enact a bill such as C-10, with all the things we know about it, if it didn't feel that somehow or other It responded to some need or desire or favor in the population. Why is that? What is it about our society that allows this to just go on and on and on, and ultimately we have a government that gives us seat 10? I don't have the answers, but we sure need to address those questions. And I would love to see a conference with the quality of the people we have here on the panels and generally in the participants that can address or start addressing that question. Because if we don't, then all we're going to do is keep repeating ourselves, this is wrong and that's wrong and that's wrong. The question is, why is it still that way and what can be done to change it? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Maître Yarosky. We have about 20 minutes left, and I'd be very happy to welcome questions with an emphasis on questions. They can be pointed questions. Please step up. Maître Yarosky asked you some questions.
Some comment as to why this government can feel that this bill is a popular bill. I mean, there must be something we in this room are missing. Well, what is it? What is it in our society? Again, I say I don't have the answer, but unless we address these questions, I don't think we're going to get beyond where we are.
Can I try to answer that? I think from my perspective what it is, and somebody alluded to it earlier, that it's easy to say, to characterize people as being soft on crime and tough on crime, and everybody wants to be tough on crime. Everybody wants to punish people who have offended. And it's easy to say you're either on the side of the victims or you're on the side of the criminals. And the difficulty, somebody I think referred to it as being a nuanced discussion, a nuanced argument, and it seems to me that those of us who are opposed to this kind of simplistic, ideological, wrong-headed approaches are having difficulty countering that oversimplified rhetoric, the slogans that are easy to understand, and it's hard to make the counter-arguments. But as I said before, I am convinced that over the last 3 or 4 years, there is a rising opinion in civil society that begins to appreciate that. I don't think it has gotten through yet to the government. I think they still believe that this is what Canadians want, and they are. And that's what the minister said today. That Canadians want this, and we're delivering. But they still are at the point of believing that Canadians want what they're delivering. I don't think they do.
Could I just ask, have you, Jim, as chairman of the Liberal caucus, or chairman in the Senate, mm-hmm. Have you done any polling on what people really feel about these issues? Or is anybody here familiar with any polling as to what the state of our public opinion is on these issues?
I certainly have. No, we certainly have not.
Maybe it's a very popular bill. Maybe it reflects what the Canadian public really wants in criminal justice.
Well, there is actually, Michael, just one second. There is actually some literature that was produced, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, by Julian Roberts on precisely this kind of thing of public perception about criminal justice issues. And his conclusions were really quite striking. That when Canadians were put to the test in sophisticated empirical studies, there was not the same kind of support for strong retributive policies. Michael?
Yeah, that's exactly right. When I appeared before Senator Cowan a couple of weeks ago, was it that long ago? Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, with my colleague Graham Stewart, he was chastened by, I think it was Senator Boisvenu, on the temerity of his statement that the public, when asked the question, what did they favor most in terms of a criminal justice system, rehabilitation as a way to improve public safety or punishment, that the majority of the respondents were in favor of rehabilitation. That concept is one which the Minister of Public Safety, Taves, has ridiculed as being an abandonment of a constitutional convention to protect the public, that you would actually believe in rehabilitation. And Mr. Stewart responded with producing a report by the Department of Justice, in Mr. Nicholson's department, which in fact, quite recently, supported the fact that most Canadians did support rehabilitation and not warehousing and a punitive response to crime. So it's not that there is a backup, you know, for that view, but what I find difficult to deal with, and I've voiced this to a number of people, and it's something I'm really struggling with as a lawyer. When I go into a courtroom, and in fact when I advise clients, what I do is I look for the best evidence. Now, I may have a wrong-headed view of what the best evidence is. Often I do, in terms of what the Crown says the best evidence is, but we rely upon a judge to be the ultimate arbiter of what the best evidence is. And then you apply legal principles and constitutional principles to that best evidence, and the result is justice according to the law. That's what I was taught. It's a difficult thing to achieve, but that's the theory of justice according to law. What do you do if you appear before a judge or a government that says to you, hey, we can shorten this debate. I'm not interested in the best evidence. That's not what concerns me. I don't need to know the best evidence, because my decision is not going to be conditioned on the best evidence. It's going to be conditioned on what I think is a popular response. Public policy is about doing what I think the public wants. And really, don't bother me about the charter or about the law or by what judges said, and perhaps, you know, Justice Healy can comment on this. Don't talk to me about the Supreme Court of Canada, because we all know that the Supreme Court of Canada and other judges for the last 30 years have mainly been appointed by Liberal governments, and they're part of, you know, an elite that somehow has been captured by this perverse view that rehabilitation is part of public safety. So don't bother me about the law, because we'll replace the law with what we think are the appropriate ways to respond to public safety. Now, as a lawyer, if the best evidence doesn't count, and if relying upon the jurisprudence and the Constitution doesn't count, I mean, where do you go? And that's the dilemma I face. And in response to your question about why is that, I think if a government is convinced, as Mr. Harper's government seems to be convinced, that it knows all the answers and is not interested in the views of whether it's the former deputy chief of the LAPD or the former draftsperson of the minimum sentencing guidelines, or if anyone else who has any really experience of what happens in prison, reasoned debate is not possible. Now, I think that's the real challenge. How do you bring reasoned debate to government policy? And for me, it's a real challenge. I hope someone else has got a better answer than I have.
Michael, I opened this session with a remark about a field of conflicting values, as described by Chief Justice Dixon. Do you foresee, because there has not been a wholesale repeal of Bill C-41, what is now Part 23 of the Criminal Code, which still makes reference to rehabilitation and the ideal of instilling a sense of responsibility in offenders and all of those things. But do you see in the future, very near future, which perhaps began with the decision by Anne Molloy in Toronto, a long run of litigation in which government policy is the central feature?
I do. I've been thinking about that in terms of kind of planning my own strategy as an activist, whatever that means. And for those people who aren't lawyers, I mean, there has developed in Canada in the last 15, 20 years a discourse in which judges, when facing challenges to legislation, have referred to a dialogue with the legislature. That in fact, when making important public policy decisions, there should be a degree of deference, judicial deference, to legislation which is in an area of conflicting values. Mm-hmm. And I think that deference may be rethought now by the government. Because if, as a lawyer, you come to court and say, this is the legislation is in the face of the best evidence, why should the judiciary, in determining its constitutionality, give any deference to a decision which, in fact, is not based upon the best evidence? And I think you saw some of that in the recent Supreme Court of Canada decision in the Insight.
Isn't that what the American courts have started to do or did with the minimum sentences in the states?
I think
They've started through interpretation to really change it through judicial decisions.
My concern, actually, in relation to Justice Healy's comment, is that it's not even that the legislation is draconian and repeals all of the previous legislation, but it's pushing in a particular direction, which, if you unhinge criminal justice policy from the best evidence and the best thinking, even though BC-10 represents just a small part of dismantling, it emboldens those who would dismantle more of it to the next step and the next step. You know, the point about the mandatory minimums, 1 year for some of the sex offense. Well, that's not enough, so the argument is. So let's make it three. Let's add to the various mandatory minimums. Let's reconfigure the rehabilitation. I mean, we've got rid of pretty much conditional sentences. What else are we going to revise in terms of the criminal code? That's my concern. It's particularly a problem, as I said, in the prisons, because Bill C-40, B-10 doesn't go as far as the government panel wanted the law to go. In fact, some very bold and principled public servants put the stops to the most draconian parts of Bill C-10 when it came to corrections. But the problem is the climate it creates. As I said, if the minister doesn't respect what actually is the best way to do corrections in accordance with human rights principles, in accordance with the best evidence, why should the warden, why should the guard on the range? I mean, I've experienced this. You know, I mentioned before when I first went into prisons, the guards had guns on me as I walked across the BC penitentiary. I now go into prisons, and the reception I get from the front gate, and I haven't been doing it quite as long as you, but almost as long as you. So I'm a senior practitioner, and I should get a certain measure of respect, even though I don't look like a lawyer. But what I find now when I go in, and it's a real barometer, I think, as Joanne St. Louis said, in terms of her experience as a black woman being mistaken or perceived to be a street worker, when I go into the prison, I take the kind of respect I get as a litmus test. If I'm being disrespected as someone who stands up for the rights of offenders, how will the offenders themselves be treated when they stand up and say this is wrong? And I'm experiencing a real pushback, you know, an attitude when I go in of young guards who've know about my books looking at me and saying, you lost, didn't you? All the things that you've done, we won. We are, in fact, in control. Our attitudes towards offenders are supported by the minister, and nothing you do makes a difference anymore. It's intangible. You know, it doesn't arise to the level of physical disrespect or abuse, but there's an undercurrent in which you take away governmental respect, and it traverses and travels through the system, and the whole apparatus of respect for human rights starts to, you know, to fall. Sorry.
Fine. Thank you, Michael. Your question, and then Judy Rebick.
I'll keep my question short, and you guys can answer as long or as short as you'd like. It seems like over the course of this conference, there have been very few people who are actually in support of C-10. My question would be, if we're mostly in agreement that it's a mess, what are some steps that we can take? What are the next steps? Do we just have to wait until 2015, or is there something else we can do?
My question's related to that, so can I just ask? Yeah, if we could have asked questions to the minister, the question I would have asked is, why is the Quebec government applying this? In 1976, the Quebec government refused to apply the abortion law successfully. It was never a challenge to them. Abortion was virtually legal in Quebec from the period of 1976. If Ontario and Quebec refuse to apply this law, is that possible legally? In other words, they refuse to build the prisons, Crowns refuse to prosecute the kind of minimum sentences or ask for them, judges refuse to give them. Is that possible to organize in the legal community? Because, I mean, it seems to me what we're talking about is not just a bad bill, we're talking about a catastrophe for a large number of people, particularly Indigenous people in this country, that this bill is going to cause young men, mostly young men, some women, and Indigenous people. And it seems to me we have to do something a little more radical than perhaps we normally think about how to defeat a law. And I think one of the ways is even bigger resistance from the provinces. And I guess what I'm asking is that if we could organize it politically, is it legally possible to do it?
I can address that. There certainly is a lot of room in the system for the exercise of discretion. Prosecutors decide what cases to prosecute and what charges to lay. And so there certainly is give room in the system if there is a will on the part of lawyers, and particularly prosecutors, and judges, well, judges would go along with that, to bend the system. That the area of discretion in our system given to the Crown is very, very large. And that's what explained, that's how the abortion thing was done, Jerry. They just didn't prosecute those abortions. So if there's a minimum sentence, for instance, of 1 year or whatever it is for a fraud of over $2 million, the Crown prosecutor can make a deal with the defense for a plea of guilty to something under that, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the Crown can refuse to prosecute certain cases. So I think, yes, to some extent, there is some room in the system for it. And Judge Malloy's judgment recently in, is it Toronto?
Yes,
in Toronto is that's very, very promising. I think it's a terrific approach. I presume most, but Judge Malloy refused to apply the minimum, is it 4 year?
Three-year
sentence for someone who's in possession of a weapon. It was a case of somebody who went into a friend's house and picked up a gun and took pictures of himself, and he was charged with this possession of illegally possession of a gun, and she held that she refused to apply the minimum sentence, holding that this is cruel and unusual punishment, and therefore contrary to the Canadian Charter of Rights. So there are things that can be done. Yes.
Last question.
It's a short question. There seems to be some discrepancy between the senator's presentation where he said our system is quite good, needs improvement, versus Mr. Yarovsky's presentation saying there's nothing that happened in the last 50 years. But Ms. Sandra Delorme said that there is a Trudeau document that's sitting, collecting dust, that could rejuvenate certain of our concerns. I just want to know, is there a discrepancy in terms of that presentation or not?
Jim, go ahead. As far as I'm concerned, no. There's still a lot of good, and we still have a terrific system, but it certainly hasn't been improved by C-10. There have been a lot of good things, and there are a lot of good policemen, and police do a lot of good things, but some pretty awful things. Yeah. No, I don't think there's a discrepancy.
No, I don't. I mean, I say this as somebody who, while I practiced law for many years, it's many, many years since I've practiced at the criminal bar, but certainly the evidence that we heard, the from the experts, the studies that we read, was that we have an excellent system, and it's not broke. There are some changes that need to be made. These are not the changes that need to be made, but it's a good system. Can I just add one comment, just a brief one? Just that I think, you know, we've been focused here, as we were on the discussion on C-10 and these very interesting last 2 days, the first of which I couldn't make, on the criminal justice system. And one of the things that I find most offensive about the government's approach to this is that they're suggesting that simply by passing another amendment to the criminal law, or yesterday they announced they're going to bring in some sort of law dealing with elder abuse, and which is important. I mean, nobody is defending elder abuse, but there's a sense that, and perhaps an expectation, that simply by bringing these bills in and passing them, that suddenly elder abuse will disappear, or that our streets and communities are safer. I think if we learn nothing more in the course of the last few months, it is that many of these issues that the government is trying to deal with in the criminal justice system are very, very deeply rooted societal issues. And we need to deal with it in terms of education, we need to deal with it in terms of homelessness, poverty. These are issues which can be at best imperfectly addressed through the criminal justice system. And if we as a society believe that by amending the criminal law that we are going to solve these problems, then we are doing a disservice to Canada. These are very, very serious problems, and we need to deal with them as a society. There may be criminal justice aspects to them, but in my view at least, the root causes have nothing to do with the criminal law.
Very briefly, Ms. de Laron, because I see that the head prefect is there.
I'll be very brief, but I just want to say, as someone who's hung around the fort at every opportunity in the criminal justice system, there is an opportunity for change. The police can divert cases through pre-charge to a restorative process. Defense and Crown can recommend a restorative process. Or if not, the judges in sentencing can recommend a restorative process. If an individual goes into corrections, they can be diverted to a healing lodge or a restorative process. So in any of this, those parts of the system where you are able to influence change or a restorative process, please take that opportunity. The research shows that restorative justice works. So take the opportunity to ensure that it has greater usage in this country.
Finally, if I may, on your behalf, may I thank our panelists for a wonderful session.
And thank you to you, Judge Healy. I'll say we have a number of closing remarks, and you're not allowed to go to the reception until we're finished them. We did try to get more people who would speak in favor of Bill C-10, but we had trouble finding them. So the first thing I want to do is invite, and this is important to us, I'd like to take a moment to introduce two outstanding McGill students to make some concluding reflections. And so I'm going to call on Eric Pousseau and Colleen Morowitz from the Faculty of Law and the Faculty of Arts, respectively, representing the two faculties involved in the organization of this. If you could come forward, either together or Eric first, I'll just read to you a little bit about them. Eric Pousseau is a student in the Faculty of Law. He was born in Ottawa, raised in Halifax, but has called Montreal home for the last 7 years. Having obtained a BA and MA in ancient history from McGill, he's currently in his second year of McGill's BCL LLB program and hopes one day to practice criminal law. Very interesting background. He fell in love with the subject matter from day one and is greatly enjoying his work with the Innocence Project at McGill. When not studying, Eric contributes to the Canadian Civil Liberties Association Rights Watch blog, coaches a master's swim team, and voraciously, his girlfriend would say, obsessively follows American and Canadian politics. So, Eric, I invite you to offer some concluding reflections.
Well, first of all, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the organizers of this conference, MISC, and everyone who put in tons of work. It's been fantastic. And to give me the chance to speak on behalf of law students and on behalf of students and youth in general. As I contemplated the task I had at the outset and I sat in the audience from the get-go, I tried to search for a theme and what I would deliver as closing remarks. And I sort of decided on the conference title. I stared at it all day, every day, for the last 2 days. And so I thought I would use the conference title as my sort of guidepost and theme for the closing remarks. But then, so quite immediately, I started to realize that there was a slight discord, maybe, in some of the panels and in some of what we heard. The theme is the future of justice in Canada, but oftentimes the conference felt like it could have been subtitled Present Injustices in Canada and the way that things are not fair here and now, especially with the passing of C-10. The first panel we dealt with the perceived impunity with which police can operate and treat citizens. We dealt with the criminalization of protest and dissent. This morning we dealt with the problems journalists have in terms of relating crime reporting and larger social issues. And we dealt with the myriad problems and horrific circumstances of sentencing and the criminal justice system. But I'd like to finish on a positive note and now sort of speak on behalf of students and thank this panel in particular for turning their attention forward-looking and what we can do going forward. I think that it's become abundantly clear, if it wasn't already so, that there's a lot of work to be done and that there's a lot of things that we need to do to improve Canada and our society. And that, as youth, we really can't forget that we are large stakeholders in the future of justice in Canada, but also, I think equally importantly, that we are the future of justice in Canada in a lot of ways, and that we can shape the future of justice in Canada by going out and doing and being proactive and changing the world. And so, as someone who's personally quite interested in criminal law, and I know it's in need of tons of reform, but I've also, one of the most important things I've learned in my brief time at law school is that there are many, many limits to the law, to the criminal law, to the law in general. And I think as almost all of these panelists here have pointed out, justice is not just criminal law and it's not just the law, and there are a million other places where Canadian society can be more just, housing, education, help for the homeless, mental health, all of these issues are extremely important and are extremely intimately bound up with justice. So on behalf of all students who've been here, and there's been a great student turnout and support of this conference, I'd like to say that I'm ready and that we are ready and willing to take up this task and try and make Canada a more just society, and that hopefully we will continue to bend that arc slowly but surely towards justice. Thank you.
And And our next respondent is Colleen Morawetz, who is a student in the Faculty of Arts at McGill. She's from Toronto. Colleen is a second-year student at McGill, where she studies political science and Canadian studies, and she's currently serving, this is much to my appreciation, as co-president of the Canadian Studies Association of Undergraduate Students. She's actively involved in student government, sitting on the Arts Undergraduate Society Legislative Council, the AUS Academic Council, and the Faculty of Arts Committee as a student representative. She's always been fascinated by Canadian politics and is particularly interested in the representation of women and minorities in both formal and informal structures. And her academic interests include political and legal theory. Colleen?
Hi, everyone. It's quite an honor to be asked to represent my faculty in thanking everyone for such a wonderful conference. And I'd like to start with a bit of an anecdote as to why I think a conference of this type has such value, to me especially. So when I was about 13 years old, in my very limited conception of Canada's justice system, I asked my father, how does a judge decide who wins a court case? And I don't know what I was expecting, maybe something about how, you know, the judge searches and the truth comes out, universal justice prevails, and whoever is guilty is punished. Well, instead he laughed and joked that, well, it's whoever's lying less wins the case. And, well, of course he was joking, and maybe asking someone who specialized in bankruptcy law wasn't really the right way for me to go about that question. But nonetheless, it got me thinking at a young age about sort of the differences between justice and law and morality, and how there's not some sort of universal conception that's translated into our legislation that's then enforced by our police and then allowing our society to be just through a legal perspective. And I think that once we start acknowledging that there's this lack of universal justice and morality that's actually present in our laws, as we can clearly see with some of the perspectives on Bill C-10, once we come to this realization, there really opens up this great space for critical discourse as to what is justice, what is legal justice, what is social justice, what are the different lenses through which we can begin to conceptualize one of the most difficult concepts in humanity. And unfortunately, I don't think there are actually that many places and spaces where this open deliberation can come out. And so that's why I appreciate this kind of conference so much. We have heard from such a multiplicity of viewpoints from all these very distinguished, very intelligent, very passionate people about what it means to have justice, to be a just society, both in our legal system, in our criminal justice system, and in Canada's very fabric of social justice. So we've heard from activists, police officers, law professors, lawyers, politicians, journalists, filmmakers, and various other distinguished perspectives as to what constitutes justice in Canada and how we can go from maybe where we are, which is not at our ideal perspective, and how we can bring ourselves into a future that is hopefully more just. And I can't think of a better time for this kind of forum to come out, given Canada's situation, and as I alluded to in a question earlier today, a situation very close to my heart, which is the current student movement in Quebec. So to have this kind of conference here on the future of justice in Canada at McGill University in Quebec in the year 2012, I think is a phenomenal opportunity. And so I would just like to thank Dr. Straw, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, all the organizers of the conference, our amazing panelists from throughout the past 2 days, and all of the participants at the conference, everyone who is here today, thank you. Thank you very much for participating in this very valuable discussion as to what is justice and how can we be a more just society. And I really hope that some of this conversation makes its way out of the faculty club, out of McGill, into Canadian society, and hopefully for the better of our country. Thank you.